The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 63. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He is one of the sharpest minds in the macro space. His name is Jeff Snyder. Jeff, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey, George, how are you doing? Hope everything's good for you down there and, surviving the shutdown and the quarantines and whatever else we got going on.
Lockdown here in Medellin.
Lockdown. Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's been in a government lockdown for almost a month. Where I've only been out of my, I've got like a 2,000 square foot kind of condo apartment here. And they only let you out once a week to go to the grocery store based on the last two digits of your ID. So it's, I can't wait for this to be over.
Great time. Yeah.
Yeah. I've eaten enough canned goods to last me the rest of my life.
Yeah. You've become a survivalist.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I like Survivor Man. I should do a vlog series on that. All right, buddy. Well, let's dive right into it. I just listened to a really cool interview that you put up on your YouTube channel. If no one's seen that, make sure you go there and subscribe. It's Alhambra Investments, I think is the name of the channel. And it, really, really interesting. But one of the main topics of discussion was the unemployment rate. And I think this is really a point of confusion for a lot of average Americans, especially when you got Trump out there, well, before the Cervasa sickness, tweeting that basically the economy consists of two things, the unemployment rate and the S&P 500. That's it. But you took it quite a few steps deeper. Do you want to explain kind of your research there?
Well, it all comes down to what, you know, we've talked about, people have talked about for a long time, going back to 2008, the participation problem, mm-hmm. which is the labor force is not what it used to be. And there's all sorts of reasons that have been given for it. Economists and central bankers have all stated that, well, the, you know, as the labor force got shrunk, diminished as a percent of the overall population, that was for various structural reasons that are not related to macro factors. But yet, when you look at and analyze the labor force behavior, it's so obvious what happened. Now, in a typical recession or business cycle, the labor force itself doesn't really change. And that makes sense. It makes intuitive sense. You know, if you're one of the unfortunate ones who are laid off from, you know, because of a recession, you don't leave the labor force. You don't have a job, but you're still looking for work. And you probably even understand that you might be out of work for months, maybe even a year, but you eventually, you expect, you intend, you're going to go back to work. And so if you look at the labor force, the trajectory of the labor force throughout all of these recessions in the post-war history, that's what happens. The labor force doesn't break. It doesn't change. It continues to grow. Even through the worst recessions we've experienced, like 1981, 82, which was a really bad recession, labor force continued to grow because, again, you don't leave the labor force because of a recession. You don't. You just don't.
So when you talk about the labor force participation expanding, are you talking about the percentage or the actual number of people?
Both in absolute terms and the percentage term, because, you know, go back to the 1980s, 1970s, even the 1990s, the participation rate expanded, as did the labor force. But it didn't matter. You go back to the 1950s or even beforehand, the labor force doesn't contract. Now, the number of people who have jobs does. That's, you know, people get laid off, people get thrown out of work. That's what happens in any kind of cyclical recession. But again, if you're one of those unfortunate few that are laid off, you don't leave the labor force. You realize the situation is bad and you have to sit out of your employment for a while, but you're still looking for work, which is what we define as the labor force. And that all changed in October 2008. For the first time in post-war American economic history, suddenly the labor force begins to contract, not just, you know, the number of people who are working, but the labor force, the people who are saying they're working, that contracted. And what that meant was not only were millions and millions of people being laid off of work, something had changed where their perception was, I've just been laid off and I don't expect to go back anytime soon, so I'm not even going to look for work anymore. That was a substantial change in the behavior of the labor market that is ignored, especially by central bankers, because what happened in October 2008? It's obvious. Financial crisis of that level and that depth. I mean, you had companies like McDonald's and Caterpillar going to the Federal Reserve trying to beg it to buy its commercial paper. So, I mean, employees understood that their employers were in deep trouble. This was no normal recession. And so they said, damn, you know, I just got laid off from my job. I don't think I'm going back to work anytime soon. So they gave up on the labor market. And from top to bottom, it was almost 2 million people. It doesn't sound like a lot when you're talking about 150 million workers, but 2 million people left the labor force, never mind the fact millions more who should have shown up, you know, as population growth continued to contribute to the labor pool, they never came into it. So we had year upon year where the absolute level of the labor force stagnated, even as the number of jobs came back. And that's why the unemployment rate started to fall, was because the denominator, the labor force, was stuck, while the numerator started to climb back up in recovery or partial recovery. And that's never been fixed. It's never been solved. And that's why the participation rate continues to be a problem.
Okay, so I think the normal pushback would be, well, yeah, Jeff, but it's because of demographics. We've got this big baby boomer generation retiring, so wouldn't that naturally drop the labor force participation rate? That would be number one. Number two would be, it sounds like the labor force participation rate is more of like a survey. So they're asking people if they plan on re-entering as opposed to something that's more quantitative. And then going back to the Great Depression, how does it compare with the labor force participation then?
Well, taking your last one first, you know, they didn't survey those things back in the Great Depression. Right. You were either in the labor force or you were out. And that's, you know, that was one of the things that drove economists nuts in the 50s and 60s, that decided that they needed to expand their definitions so that we have, you know, underemployed and we have part marginally attached and all these different various functions. The second thing you mentioned was, you know, do they survey properly? Well, I mean, the survey is the survey. And if people tell them that they're not looking for work for whatever reason, they don't assign a reason, they don't necessarily assign a reason, it still doesn't matter. We still have underparticipation. We still have marginally attached people who are not really looking for work, but they would like to work. And then the first thing, you know, baby boomers, that's been debunked because, number one, they didn't all get together in October 2008 and decide, we're going to start retiring right now, because that would be the worst time to do it while everybody's 401k. You remember the old joke, your 401ks are all 201ks. You know, the last thing you want to do is retire when the stock market's getting cratered. And the other thing is the labor force participation rate for people above 55 and especially people above 65 has expanded. It has risen since 2008. So baby boomers are putting off retirement. They're not retiring. And so that's not a problem. What economists have largely said to try to explain the labor force participation problem without blaming central bankers for the global financial crisis, they've come up with something called R-star. Now, R-star is supposedly a bunch of supply factors that are beyond the control of monetary policy. Things like the labor force itself, rather than baby boomers retiring, what they're saying is that, okay, Americans who used to work in old factory types jobs, they'll no longer go back to school and learn to code. That's a structural problem that the Federal Reserve can't commit. There's a bunch of people who have discovered heroin and opioids. So the opioid crisis has been used as a means to try to explain why the labor force won't grow. And it's all, you know, it's all bunk. I mean, it's just they're trying to reverse engineer so that you don't go back looking at October 2008 and wonder, and connecting these two dots, global financial crisis, labor force is broken for the first time since the Great Depression. I mean, the two things go intuitively together, but yet, if you're an economist or central banker, the last thing you want to do is connect those two dots.
Right. So do you think that's a matter of people just getting frustrated, or do you think it's a matter of continual regulations and a less dynamic economy because of the Fed's intervention or more government allocating or misallocating resources? Can you pinpoint what it may be, or is it just a combination of all those things, or am I way off?
No, I think it's a macro thing. Look, I mean, you know, Ben Bernanke said the economy was recovering when the labor force says it wasn't. I mean, it's a disconnect. Why do we listen to what Ben Bernanke had to say? He performed so awfully in 2008 and then afterwards. But yet he has every incentive to tell you that it's something else is I didn't screw up with something else. It's your fault, you bunch of drug addicted, lazy Americans. I mean, right. It's so absurd, and it's so, you know, and it's insulting. He screwed it up. It's very clear that he screwed it up. And what the labor force is saying, and the lack of participation in the post-crisis era, is that no, we aren't seeing recovery. So we're not going to go joining the labor force. We're going to stick on unemployment because at least we're getting something there. And so, you know, it plays out in all of these factors, especially over the last two or 3 years when the unemployment rate got down as low as it got to be. Because, look, if the unemployment rate was anywhere close to accurate, we should have seen that inflationary breakout that everybody was talking about in 2017 and 2018. That's what Jay Powell was saying. Look, we didn't screw up. We're right about our star. And if we're right about our star, the unemployment rate means we're going to see massive wage inflation because the labor force is so unbelievably tight. And it never happened. The reason it didn't happen is because they got it all wrong. Our star is incorrect. There is a huge amount of slack. There is this labor force participation problem because of macro factors that the central bank never created recovery conditions going all the way back to 2008.
Yeah. Would it make sense to measure the amount of welfare compared to the unemployment rate to see if the unemployment rate is going down, but the welfare is going up? Therefore, there must be something wrong with that unemployment rate.
Yeah, and you can do that with not just unemployment benefits, but also things like SNAP, the what you used to call food stamps, which you're not allowed to call food stamps anymore. Supplemental nutrition.
We are on this channel, Jeff. You don't have to worry about that here, buddy.
I know. Hey, but we have to call it SNAP because that's what it is. No, so you can link those two things. Disability insurance, you know, disability payments obviously skyrocketed after the crisis, and that was because workers who knew they were not going back to work. What else are you going to do? If the government has all these programs, you apply for them. And then, if you still can't get a job, you stay on disability as long as you possibly can. And it's funny how the absolute level of the labor force bottomed out in I think it was September, October 2015, once they reinstituted the work requirements for SNAP. It was all of a sudden people were looking for jobs, or at least telling the BLS they were looking for jobs. Once they said, hey, if you want to qualify for food stamps, you got to tell me that you were looking for a job. You know, the idea of our star, the mainstream explanation of lazy, drug addicted Americans has it all backwards. You know, it was the lack of recovery from 2008, a broken economy that broke the labor force that drove Americans into, suicide, drug addiction, government dependence, all of these bad things that happened in the wake of it were not the cause of the labor force problems. They were they were coming from the labor force problems.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you got the Fed putting in a Fed put into the stock market, which incentivizes all of these corporations to buy back their shares instead of expanding their businesses, investing for the future, and hiring more people and creating more rock solid jobs. In my opinion, it all just goes back to the Fed and the way they pervert the incentive structure in the real economy and in the financial economy.
Yeah, all those things are what you call recovery, right? That's where recovery comes from. Recovery mm-hmm. comes from businesses who are expanding because they say, hey, the economy had a temporary downturn. Now we're back to business as usual. We're a little bit behind. So we got to rev up. We got to rev up a production. We got to rev up investment. We got to catch up to where we would be. And that didn't happen after 2008. And you have to ask yourself why. You know, it wasn't baby boomers who all got together at once and said, hey, we're retiring. That right. wasn't it. Heroin wasn't discovered in October of 2008, right? I mean, it's ridiculous to even think that. We know what happened in October 2008. Everybody around the world, even if they didn't pay attention to the stock market, they knew there was a financial crisis in 2008. And that has, as we've seen throughout history, I mean, John Maynard Keynes had this right back in the 1920s. Monetary deflation that becomes a monetary crisis is devastating directly in the labor market. He connected those two things, and he was absolutely right. Inflation destroys savings, whereas deflation, monetary deflation, destroys labor. And that's exactly what we've seen. We had a global monetary crisis in 2008, and oh, by the way, for the first time in post-war history, you have devastation in labor markets. Connect the dots. I mean, it's really not hard to do, but if you don't have the incentive to actually, hey, that was my fault, my bad, I'm sorry. Right. Our star sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And then how does that disproportionately affect the younger generations? Because they're just coming into the job market during this time of stress and when these quote unquote good jobs just aren't available. And a lot of the people are just checking out of the labor market altogether. And on top of that, you have more of the retirees not retiring and competing for those jobs.
The labor market is, in some senses, rigid, and it becomes even more rigid, where companies aren't willing to, you know, take a risk on hiring new employees when they know what they've got, who's already there.
Right.
And it becomes almost like a hiring freeze, right? Because anybody who's trying to enter the labor market, they find there's no takers for their services. And so you can understand why, people of the millennial generation and the next generation coming behind them, they stay in school for 2, 3, 4 extra years. It's a form of breadline, right? It's a way to make a living without being able to work. And so they've racked up a massive amount of debt for very little return because there's nothing waiting for them behind it. It's again, Keynes had it right in the 20s. It's the labor market which gets devastated by these monetary events. And, you know, that's what bothers me the most, because everybody says, well, the Fed created a flood of liquidity in QE. Well, no, that's not what happened. It's, you know, it's persistent deflationary conditions, which has kept a lid on labor market healing. And it's gotten to the point where now we're 12 years later, and now we get to experience another one. And, I can't even imagine what this one's going to look like.
Yeah, I know you've been calling it the GFC number 2. But do you think those deflationary pressures and the problems in the labor market, in the broad economy, in the real economy, stem from the Fed keeping interest rates artificially low and doing quantitative easing? Or what do you think produces those negative results?
Yeah, and I think that gets causation flipped around too. We're all taught from the very beginning the Fed controls everything. And if it wants to, it can do whatever the hell it wants. You know, that's the Greenspan put, that's don't fight the Fed, the old slogan. And it's just not true. And the fact is, we believe that the Fed not only controls the federal funds rate, it controls all interest rates. Mm-hmm. We're led to believe that, bond yields, U.S. Treasury yields, the Fed controls them. I mean, they buy bonds, for example. But that's not what happens. It's exactly opposite. The bond market is the Fed's biggest critic. The bond market has been off the Federal Reserve game for the last dozen years. Bond yields fall independently of whatever the Federal Reserve is doing. And as we observed over the last couple of years, the bond market predicts what Jay Powell's not going to do, reacts to it. The bond market started rallying, Treasury yields started falling, while he was still thinking he was going to hike rates. November, December of 2018, you started to see yields come down when we're supposed to have this inflationary breakout, and Jay Powell was still considering hiking rates. But that's not what happened. So lower bond yields are telling you that the monetary system is not behaving. And it's what Milton Friedman once called the interest rate fallacy, because we're led to believe that low interest rates are the responsibility of central bank and that they equal stimulus. When in fact, low interest rates throughout history, especially periods like the 1930s, when interest rates were low throughout the Great Depression, low interest rates are a sign of tightness, monetary tightness in the real economy. So the lower bond yields go and the longer they remain that way, that's a sign that the Fed is not doing its job. And it's completely contrary to what we're all taught and led to believe.
And that monetary tightness is a result of lack of demand for the money in the real economy?
Well, I think the demand is there. It's a lack of supply. You know, the banking system was essentially broken in August of 2007 and has never been fixed. In some ways, that's a good thing because, the banking system throughout the 90s and 2000s was just insanely stupid. I mean, it did all sorts of crazy things that just boggle the mind and make you shake your head. And so in the one sense, yeah, we're glad that the banks are not taking absurd risks like they used to be, except we have to realize the monetary system absolutely required that kind of behavior so that we had monetary and liquidity growth. And without that obscene and insane behavior, the system is deprived of sources of liquidity. And so you can't have it both ways. You have to pick one or the other. Either we need the banks to go back to being risky and stupid, or we got to do something else. We got to change the entire monetary system. We can't have it continue to be one or the other. And so, that's what the bond low interest rates are telling us. Yes, banks are behaving differently, but we need them to go back to the way they used to behave.
Right. So the key component to the problem is that the monetary system is broken. And I also want to remind people that during times of quantitative easing, 1, 2, 3, and who knows what's going to happen in quantitative easing infinity, which we're in right now. But during those first three quantitative easings, interest rates on the long end of the curve, on the 10-year especially, went up, not down.
And that's, you know, George, that's a good point, because that's what we want to happen. In fact, when interest rates would rise in reaction to quantitative easing, that was a sign the bond market was saying, hey, maybe this stuff would work. Because if we have an inflationary recovery like we're supposed to get, bond, you know, yields are going to rise. That's rising yields are a sign that the economy is being fixed. Because why did you want to own the safest, most liquid instruments when the economy is booming? You don't want to own those things. And so liquid instruments are sold off. We'd have a massive bond rout or bond massacre if the world was behaving. And we would all celebrate that kind of thing. Rising interest rates from where they are now would be a tremendously positive outcome. Mm-hmm. So what was happening during quantitative easing, as the Fed was buying securities, was interest rates are kind of all over the place. There was no one direction or another. In fact, if you look at all the academic studies, especially those produced by the central bank, the most charitable of them conclude that maybe quantitative easing lowered term premiums. Didn't reduce rates, it didn't create a recovery. Maybe perhaps it lowered term premiums in the bond market. That's the best that can be said about quantitative easing, because the truth of the matter is interest rates and bond yields fell far more when the Fed wasn't doing QE than when it was. Right. And that reason is because the bond market is saying, as yields fall, high demand for the most safe liquid instruments, that we have liquidity risk, that we have monetary risk, that the monetary system is not behaving and not responding to the Fed. The Fed is not flooding the system. And so, again, it gets back to the interest rate fallacy and how convention has it all backwards. The bond market is independent of the central bank.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So how does oil and what we've seen recently in the price of oil tie into this whole thesis, Jeff?
Well, part of it is, you know, just asset deflation, right? If in tight money, you should a deflationary tight money period, you expect oil prices to decline, commodity prices to decline, as they did in, you know, post-2014 environment, which was another really big liquidity episode, 2014 and 2015. That's what precipitated the oil crash. But George, if you're talking about what's happened over the last week, I think it's a combination of a couple things. Number one, we had the oil crash that happened in, you know, March, where the curve just just got taken out. Because again, you know, what I call global financial crisis number two, where the oil market has to adjust to two factors. There's the short run factor of, you know, obviously this is a non-economic dislocation. We've got, like you said, the entire country shut down for, you know, completely shut down. That's going to cause a drop in demand, but it's a short-run drop in demand. And I think a lot of people are expecting that once the shutdowns are lifted, the quarantines are lifted, we're going to have this V-shaped recovery going back to normal relatively quickly. It'll be very optimistic. Yeah, a short-lived, but, you know, very painful, but ultimately not long-lasting event. What the oil market is saying, yeah, that's probably the case. And the front end of the oil curve is trading all over the place because it's hard to tell just how much chaos and disruption the market's going to have to absorb in the short run. But what we've seen recently, what happened this week, was that the oil market has to further adjust to the idea that this is not going to be just a short run thing. This is going to be a longer term disruption. And that's the real message here, is that, yeah, okay, we've got a big problem today, but tomorrow's starting to look a little questionable too. And by the way, next year is looking even more questionable. And it gets into the same kinds of factors that we saw in 2008, 2009, where it's, yeah, we have a big downdraft for whatever reason, but we're also looking at the prospect of not having another recovery.
Right. So when you're looking at an indicator for what's going to happen in the next year or two in the real economy, you're saying basically ignore the stock market and focus on the oil market and the bond market.
Yeah, and well, even the stock market is still well below its previous high. I mean, it's come back, but, you know, markets never go in a straight line anyway. There's always bear market rallies or dead cat bounces, whatever you want to call them. And so I don't think, you know, I don't see stocks being as all that optimistic either. It's really a matter of, okay, we've got a short run disruption. Everybody knows it's going to be bad, but what comes next? How bad is what comes next? Are we going to go right back to normal? Are we going to have a V-shaped recovery? like people were betting on in the May 2020 oil contract? Or are we going to have much, you know, demand destruction that, again, plays hell in the labor market for a second time? And if you look at bonds, you look at oil, you look at, you know, euro dollar futures, any number of monetary curves, LIBOR is another one. There's a great deal of expectation that we're not done with the downside yet. The downside is not just March and April and maybe May, that this is going to be a long run and one another long run disruption.
Okay, so maybe the stock market is going to follow the oil market or the bond market down, because yes, we've seen this recovery, but they're kind of going in opposite directions, where you're saying the stock market most likely will kind of come back around to the oil market and the bond market instead of vice versa.
Yeah, and that's what always happens. I mean, you go back to 2008, for example, you know, from the high in October 2007 until Bear Stearns failed in March 2008, you know, you had a pretty serious decline in the stock market. And then from, you know, the middle of March 2008 until I think it was late May 2008, the market rallied. And it rallied pretty significantly, so that, you know, by the end of May, or toward the end of May of 2008, it wasn't all that far below its previous high. And, you know, we're talking about 2008 in the middle of the Great Recession. The market was looking like maybe this is all a big nothing. And then, of course, the next wave happened later in the latter half of 2008, which wiped everything out. And, you know, so these kinds of rallies can take place. In fact, they always take place inside of what are crisis markets or bear markets, whatever, however you want to call them, because nothing ever goes in a straight line. There's always a back and forth. There's always a great deal of uncertainty.
What do you think the next crisis is? And what I mean by that, Jeff, is if you look at what the Fed's doing right now with this alphabet soup type of program, where they're literally backstopping everything. I did a video on this the other day where I counted at least four or five specific programs that were just intended to give money and bail out the corporate America, the big corporations. So if, and I think the Fed, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're being much more proactive this time around than they were in 2008. So is it possible that we might not have the Lehman moment this time around because the Fed has just throwing money at every single person or every single entity that's raising their hand? And if the Fed just takes all of the, or proactively takes all those bad assets off the balance sheets of the private sector and puts them onto their balance sheet, will that not cure it, but will that prevent it from this major collapse? Because if all the assets and if all the debt is on the Fed's balance sheet, they can take an unlimited haircut.
Well, I think that's a big, grave misconception. The Fed is not buying every asset that's on offer. In fact, they want you to think that. They want you to think that, hey, we can support any market that's out there. That's the, you know, that's expectations policy.
They're duping me extremely well. I'm taking it hook, line, and sinker, buddy.
That's why, you know, I love the Bank of Japan's example, because the Bank of Japan, quote unquote, is buying stocks and has been buying stock for half a decade. Right. And what happened in March was the Nikkei started going down, and it went down substantially. I think it was 10, 15% by that point. And the Bank of Japan, of course, stepped up its stock buying. Which it didn't. It doesn't buy stocks; it buys ETFs. But still, same thing, right? It stepped up its ETF buying, which lasted all of one day. It did record ETF buying, in the Nikkei bounced for one day, and then the next day, on March 3rd, it was right back to tanking again. Top to bottom, the Nikkei fell 31%. Now, it fell 31%, even though the Bank of Japan is "quote unquote" supporting that market. So even if you believe that the Bank of Japan's purchases of stocks or ETFs were the reason it was only 31%, it was still 31%. And I don't think anyone would reasonably consider a 31% downdraft as supporting a market. And the reason why is, you know, when a market goes down, like when you get into a market rout, you have bankers and you have brokers all over the world fielding calls from their panicky clients saying, sell, 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 sell. Jay Powell is not going to pick up that phone in lieu of the banker or broker and say, well, I'll buy. What the Fed actually does is it has a list that the open market desk is authorized to buy on a daily basis. That's all it does. It buys a few shares of this, a few shares of that. And in the corporate bond market, a few shares of this ETF or that ETF. That is not the same as buying up every asset that's being offered in a fire sale. In fact, it's not even close to the same. But they want you to think that it is, so that you won't sell. That's the whole point. The Fed is trying to get you to do its job for it. If I make you believe that I'm buying up every offer, then you won't sell and we won't have a problem. We're trying to nip it in the bud, but we're not doing it with real money or real effort. We're doing it with psychology, which is, you know, pardon my French, horseshit. And that's what it always is. It's what it always comes down to, is the Fed is trying to get everyone else to do its job for it because it can't do that job. There's no way the Fed could buy up every asset. There's no way the Fed could take all of those calls from panicky clients. It's just not going to happen. But if everybody believes that it happens, then it's like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny.
So that's why they come out and do these press releases where they're saying they're doing $125 billion a day in quantitative easing. They're committing to $1 trillion a day in the repo market. It's all just smoke and mirrors to make sure that the people who own shares don't sell or right. bond.
Or buy. If you, oh, I got to front run the Fed. The Fed's going to support this market. There's no risk at all. I better get in there before the prices go. I mean, that's exactly, they're trying to create those kinds of perceptions because that, they believe, is an effective way to forestall the downside case. But again, you know, when push comes to shove, which I think we're heading into, you know, when we start to see actual losses, actual defaults in the corporate bond market, and they start to, you know, the corporate bond, especially the high yield stuff, starts to get a little jittery again, you know, the open market desk has a rigid list that the bureaucracy has determined that they'll buy on that particular day. And, you know, that's not going to help when all the banks and brokers are fielding the same kind of panicky sell calls that they fielded in March. And even, you know, the Bank of Japan is a perfect example. It took them, I think it was 17 days to raise the level of ETFs they were purchasing while the Nikkei was melting down. Mm-hmm. Because a central bank operates as a bureaucracy. It's not a dynamic bank where, again, you can funnel all these panicky calls into their operations. They have a list of authorized securities. And it's a list that doesn't change day after day unless, you know, there's a board meeting and a member vote and all these other kinds of things. It doesn't respond dynamically to the dynamic conditions in the market. So even if the Fed could buy everything, it would only motivate itself to do that after it's over with. Right. So it really doesn't support a market. It plays like it can. It pretends that it can.
Yeah, that's incredible. Very eye-opening. That's such a great take on it. I never really thought about it that way. Although I've done so many videos on you saying, or with this exact same opinion that, or this exact same theory that the Fed is trying to manipulate everything just through psychology, it never dawned on me that this particular part of it could also be psychology. It's just absolutely fascinating for sure. So we've covered that. I want to get into some technical stuff, just so I can better understand it. And then I think some of my viewers can understand how these things work from an operational standpoint. So going back to the dollar, and I know you've really have your opinions on this as well, and the oil market. If oil is going down, does that put more pressure on the dollar? Does that put more downward pressure, or does that create more demand? And the way I'm thinking through this is, if oil goes down to, let's say, $10 a barrel, you've got a lot of the countries and entities that normally would sell oil to get dollars to pay back that dollar-denominated debt. So they're getting fewer dollars, so that might increase the demand for dollars, while at the same time, those countries that are importing oil need less dollars to buy the oil. So how do those two cross currents play out, or am I seeing it wrong?
Well, I think it's the same thing as before. It's a dollar squeeze either way you want to look at it. So, you know, there are fewer dollars going overseas, but there's fewer dollars available for those countries to use for global trade. And without the global banking system to supply dollars in lieu of mercantile trade, whether it's oil or, you know, Brazil resources or, you know, whatever, you have a dollar squeeze. It's going to force the dollar higher because these countries don't have the dollars they require to operate their economies on a normal basis. So fewer mercantile dollars in the sale of oil or any kind of commodity leads to further shortage, a further global shortage in the dollar system. And that's dollar exchange value positive. It pushes it further up. Same as a short squeeze does in any kind of stock market.
Do you see the swap lines that the Fed set up as alleviating some of that pressure, or is that more psychology?
No, I think it's
now you've got me second guessing everything, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I think the swap lines, if I think they've actually harmed more than they help, because they've created what is a perverse set of incentives that is now impacting the euro markets. I think an easy way to think about it is this: you have two parallel reservoirs that have been impacted by a severe drought, and so the level of water in each of these reservoirs is down, which is a metaphor for the global liquidity in global system. And what the Fed has done through its dollar swap, the Fed can't make it rain. They can't pour water into a reservoir. So what they've done to try to alleviate their shortage in their reservoir is to dig a canal between the other one and its one and siphon off some of the water that's in the other reservoir. And that's what we've seen. It doesn't alleviate the dollar shortage because, again, LIBOR is still way too high. I mean, LIBOR, yeah, it got below 1% yesterday for the first time in over a month, but it's still 1%. It's coming down very slowly, which tells you that liquidity is still very tight in the global system. What has happened in the swap market is the cross-currency basis and other swap indications have gone completely crazy. And now we've seen illiquidity growing in euro markets because they're not increasing systemic liquidity. They're just playing like whack-a-mole, where it just moves the target from one place to the next. They don't increase liquidity across the whole system. They're just creating a different incentive structure that they hope, I guess, plays on people's sentiment that they just start. The system itself does their job for them.
So when you talk about LIBOR, and I'm assuming you're talking about the spread between LIBOR and like Fed funds, for the average viewer, why is that a big deal?
Well, it's a measure. It's supposed to be a measure of credit spread, right? Because LIBOR is an unsecured rate. It's what two banks would lend to each other in offshore dollar markets. Mm-hmm. And so, if I'm charging, say, 1% in 3 months LIBOR and the 3 months T-bill, which is the TED spread, the difference between LIBOR and the 3 months T-bill, the 3 months T-bill is 11 basis points as it was yesterday, and LIBOR is about, 99 basis points. That 88 basis point spread means I'd rather lend to the federal government because it's risk-free and the liquidity is there in the treasury bill. Whereas if I'm going to lend to you, I'm going to need an enormous spread to do it because I perceive either you or the system being that risky. That's what the TED spread tells you. The banks inside the system are saying something ain't right here. I don't want to lend unsecured unless I get an enormous payday to do it. 88 basis points is an enormous spread. It doesn't sound like much. I mean, LIBOR is at 1%. That's a low rate. No. The spread of 88 basis points is an enormous spread. That's a crisis level spread. And what it tells you is the banks in the system are perceiving the system as being so risky, they got to get paid a lot in order to do these kinds of things.
Got it. So in order to not park their money at the Fed, they've got to get paid 8 times what they would get for parking it at the Fed because of so much perceived risk in the system. Yeah,
The more important part of that is, LIBOR was up to 1.45%, a couple weeks ago, early April. I'm going off of memory. It was up to about 145 basis points. So if the Fed has flooded the world with liquidity, it's expanded its balance sheet by trillions. There's a trillion more in bank reserves. Why has LIBOR only come down 45 basis points?
Right.
I mean, ask yourself that question. If we're flooded with liquidity, why is LIBOR meandering lower, not sinking like a stone and going right back to normal? It's not. The Fed is not creating liquidity. It's barely keeping up with, the liquidity destruction from the private system. That's the part that people don't understand and don't really, and I sympathize why they don't understand it, because you're never taught about this hidden private shadow money system. So if the Fed is creating trillions, it's only because there must be trillions of destruction that you don't see. That's why LIBOR is high. It's the illiquidity and monetary destruction that has taken place in the private system that you don't see that is causing all of these problems. And the Fed is just not set up to respond properly to it. And even if it could, like I said before, it's a bureaucracy. It's not a dynamic place. It's not set up to support markets. It's just beyond its capabilities in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah. And that's even if they understood the problem, which they most likely don't.
Yeah, and that would be giving them way too much very charitable of interpretation. No, they're just as confused as everybody else.
So, Jeff, going back to the TED spread, how did that behave back in 2008 and 2009 compared
exact
to
exact same way? I mean, exactly the same. I just wrote about this today. I haven't posted it yet, but it's eerie how similar it is. What you saw, especially in the first half of the global financial crisis up until Lehman Brothers, was that LIBOR skyrocketed in August of 2000. The TED spread skyrocketed as LIBOR did in August of 2007 as the crisis broke out. And then it would go up and down, but it would never come back down to normal. And it would go up. It would cause all sorts of problems and angst. And it would lead to the Ben Bernanke's Fed doing things like rate cuts and TAF auctions and dollar swaps. And for a while, people would say, "Oh, that look, the Fed is flooding the world with liquidity. Look at LIBOR coming down." But then it would go right back up. And again, the point was, you know, it went up and down and up and down, but it never normalized, which is what we're seeing now. Yes, LIBOR will go up and down. The TED spread will go up and down, but it's not reacting as if it would if there had been an actual flood of liquidity. And that's what happened in 2008. You saw LIBOR and the TED spread spike three or four times before we ever got to Lehman Brothers. And every time it would go back down, everybody would say, "Ah, the Fed did it. Congratulations, Brent Bernanke. You flooded the world with liquidity." And then it would just pop right back up. And everybody would be like, "Well, what the hell just happened?" And Ben Bernanke would do more. Okay, you know, we did TAF auctions. We did dollar stops. We'll increase the amounts of these and we'll flood the world with even more liquidity. And LIBOR would come back down. The TED spread would come back down. And then it'd pop right back up again. So, you know, it's the perception that the Fed is flooding liquidity when it's not. And this persisting TED spread or this abnormal TED spread is telling you we have a fragile situation that is not being fixed by what the central banks are doing. And the way LIBOR has behaved over the last 4 or 5 weeks is exactly the same as it behaved in late 2007 and early 2008.
All right. So their playbook, it sounds like, is just completely reactionary, smoke and mirrors, and psychology.
Right. And we saw that in March, right? I mean, no matter what the Fed did to the first 18 days of March, it was fire sale liquidations across the entire world. And it got so bad that even treasury market liquidity was impacted and everybody was funneled into the on-the-run treasury bills for repo consideration. So, I mean, did the Fed magically discover the right number on March 18th and March 19th? Well, no. The market got reached its settled state regardless of what the Fed did. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a change in program that caused the market to stop its fire sale liquidation. They were helpless as a kitten up until that point, no matter what they did. I mean, you know, remember the Sunday night with the great announcement of QE forever and, you know, upping it. I mean, what did the market do the very next day? It tanked. Yeah. It was huge. So, I mean, the Fed is all smoke and mirrors. It's all psychology. When push comes to shove, there is no Greenspan put. What they want you to believe is that there is one of those things, that they can support markets, so that the next morning you say, "Well, maybe I won't call my broker and panic sell." That's, but you know, if you do, they're powerless to stop it. And you know, it's an indication of a very fragile system, not one that's fortified and robust by all of this, you know, central bank gobbledygook. And as you pointed out, this, you know, alphabet soup of acronyms. The more acronyms they are, the less enthused you should be.
Do you think the fiscal response had something to do with the market turning? Or was that more smoke and mirrors?
I don't think it had much to do with either. Because people forget, too, that was a 2008 crisis era thing, too. You know, the Bush tax cuts, which was the same thing, payments to every American that happened in, you know, March, April, and May of 2008 that didn't really do much either. So I know what happened to me, in my view, is that, you know, we have these seasonal quirks, these calendar bottlenecks that relate to window dressing. Every time you look at it. It's not a range.
Talking about the dollar funding markets, right? The plumbing with the dollar funding markets. Okay.
Bank balance sheet construction, bank balance sheet offer, contraction, all these kinds of things. Window dressing. 2 weeks before each quarter end, especially the March quarter and the September quarter, there's always that seasonal low point. Bear Stearns, when did it fail? 2 weeks before the quarter end in March of 2008. What did we just have? We had a March 2020, 2 weeks before the quarter end. It you know, the pressure was off. We got past that seasonal bottleneck and things started to go back to normal. It's beyond the capability of the central bank to comprehend, let alone try to actively deal with.
And we can take that back to repo September 17th as well, right? That seasonal bottleneck that you're referring to?
Yep, March and September. These are quarters, and it's always 2 weeks before the quarter. You're right, because September of 2019, we had that repo event happen. It was relatively benign, and it didn't spread elsewhere. But when did Lehman Brothers and AIG fail in 2008? September, 2 weeks before the quarter end. It's that seasonal low point that can expose the worst kinds of liquidity conditions.
Wow.
And so once you get past it, if it hasn't destroyed enough that, you know, you can get to a settled state where it looks like things are getting better. But as we see with TED spread and LIBOR, The market's saying, no, things aren't getting better. We just got past that first wave.
Got it. That's incredibly fascinating. I there's so many questions I have, but you've really opened my eyes tremendously. So I appreciate it, Jeff. Going back to a more fundamental question or operational question on how things work, if in the dollar. So if we've got this dollar demand outside of the United States, I know one of the arguments is always, well, if these entities that have the dollar demand, if they default, then that means there's going to be less demand for dollars. So, and we, most of us know that if you pay back a loan, then that reduces the supply of money. But if you default on a loan, does that also reduce the supply of money? And does it reduce the demand for dollars?
Depends on what happens on the, whoever owns the paper. But I would say, you know, look, there is no lower demand for dollars. You need dollars regardless of whether you default or not, because the world is denominated in dollars. The global reserve currency is the U.S. dollar. And it's actually this euro dollar system I'm talking about, which supplies the liquidity for that. Doesn't matter if you default or not. You need dollars. You have to have them regardless. So it's almost like an independent demand function that has less to do with a credit built up, because the credit built up talks about, and it deals with dollar demand in the past. You're always, you default on past dollar obligations, you still have future dollar obligations. Mm-hmm. So in fact, defaulting on dollar obligations actually makes your situation that much worse, because you've just convinced the market to make, you know, to raise the price of lending more dollars that you're going to need regardless. So that's why countries and even individual countries or individual companies try their hardest to avoid default, because you don't want to get shut out of dollar funding markets, because experience shows that it's a disaster.
Right. So how do you see the asset side of the balance sheet for these entities outside the United States that might have dollar denominated debt, and they will have in the future, but they also have dollar denominated assets? Is it correct to think that they might be able to offload some of these dollar denominated assets to pay the dollar denominated debt and therefore reduce some of that pressure?
Yeah, but then that gets into the bankruptcy spiral, right? Because, you know, like any company that's going bankrupt, if you start to sell off your assets to try to pay your debt, you're just impeding your ability to pay future obligations, and you're almost guaranteeing your bankruptcy. Mm. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is do that kind of thing where you're tempted to sell assets to pay for past debts, because, you know, that's exactly why people are starting to reevaluate China's Silk and Road Initiative, because that's kind of what's going on. They get you hooked on dollars and make you pay back in renminbi, which you can't. Therefore, we're going to seize all your assets. You know, that's a straight path to bankruptcy. And I think the more interesting question, I think what you were alluding to, George, was what happens to the banks that own the paper on the default? Does that cause any impacts there? And the answer is, I think it does. And it depends on what kind of climate they're taking losses or taking perceived losses in, because there's only so much you can do with those kind of things. If you have some kind of emerging market or overseas euro bond that's denominated in U.S. dollars and it looks like it's going to default, you know, likely that's being used as collateral someplace in repo markets or FX transactions. So not only are you staring at prospective losses on the balance sheet, the income statement flowing into the balance sheet, you've also got funding difficulties, because if you can't use that security in repo markets, what are you going to do otherwise? So, I mean, there's a tortured web of complications about how all of these things play out. And we really haven't seen that happen before, at least not since 2008 with subprime mortgages and prime mortgage bonds. And it can become a real nasty mess for both issuer and buyer.
And that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sorry for bouncing around here, Jeff, but that reminded me of another question going back to the Fed and them doing, let's just call it QE infinity. And I'm assuming they're buying bills and they're buying the long end of the yield curve. But I know you've written so much about the shortage of pristine collateral, which is basically T-bills in the repo market and the dollar funding markets. How does that work when the Fed is buying limitless amounts of pristine collateral and taking it out of the system and onto their balance sheet?
Well, it's absolutely harmful, because if they're taking some of the, especially treasury bills, out of the market, you know, even the Fed even made mention of this fact in, not the repo part of it, but how bad it had gotten in terms of collateral in its March 2020 statement. They noted how everybody had been funneled into the OTR part of the market, which on the run is the most liquid treasury security, which are all treasury bills, which is why treasury bills are the most prized of pristine collateral, because they're always liquid. They're the most liquid instrument. And repo markets, that's all anybody cares about. It's not the credit characteristics of the issuer. It's if I lend you cash, you give me a treasury bill in as collateral for that cash. If you default on the cash, I got to sell this treasury bill that you've given me, and I got to be assured that there's a market to do it tomorrow. So all I care about is if I have this collateral, what can I sell it tomorrow for? Can I sell it in a reasonable market? And that's why you see the collateral bottleneck in terms of corporate bonds and high junk bonds, especially in March, because some of those corporate junk bond markets were bidless. So as a repo market participant, I'm not going to accept your junk because I don't even know if I can sell it for any price tomorrow, which made me or you, because you're trying to borrow my cash, you had to go seek out some kind of collateral that was liquid. And it had gotten so bad that the only thing that was reliably, dependably liquid were treasury bills. And so if the Fed is buying up treasury bills for quantitative easing, trying to fool everybody into believing it's flooding the market liquidity with its smoke and mirrors, it was actually making the situation that much worse, which is why I believe you've seen quantitative easing scaled back so much over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks or whatever it's been since the peak. They didn't stay at peak buying levels for too long because they realized, you know, we're taking collateral out of the system that it badly needs.
Right. Okay. And one thing I think you've written on that can be very confusing, and even I get confused on it quite often, is why one of these primary dealer banks or hedge funds, financial institutions, would prefer to have a 3-month T-bill compared to just cash.
Well, because it's useful across repo markets. It's something you can lend out to desperate hedge funds, right? If a hedge fund used to be repoing based on a junk bond, you know, first of all, you got to think of these participants. They're not just doing individual transactions, the portfolio transactions. So if you can imagine a hedge fund, for example, that has a portfolio of securities and it's trying to, you know, the whole reason you use repo is because it provides the greatest amount of funding leverage. It's the cheapest option. And so if you're repoing, you're funding your balance sheet, all these assets in your balance sheet through repo markets, you've got to post collateral. So if you're a dealer bank and you know that this hedge fund is going to run into problems because it's repoing junk or it's trying to post junk into the repo market, you know at some point they're going to come knocking on your door looking for pristine collateral, and they'll pay anything because the option for that hedge fund who has only junk collateral is fire sale, out of business. So the hedge fund's going to pay through their nose for the treasury bill because it just wants to survive until tomorrow.
I see. Because to get the cash liquidity, they'd have to fire sell something at pennies on the dollar,
which will just lead to further problems. And the bankruptcy spiral in a financial setting. Once you get into the fire sale situation, everybody knows you're in trouble. You're not going to get any liquidity for anything. You're out of business in a hurry. You're out of business in a heartbeat. So, you know, it doesn't matter what you have to pay for a treasury bill. You pay the freight. You pay as much as you have to just to survive until tomorrow and hope that by tomorrow, Ben Bernanke or, you know, Jay Powell will have fixed it, or, you know, the Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny will do something. You know, that's what it really is. It's complete survival at that point. It's just, I can't fire sale something, so I got to pay through the nose to rent good collateral to keep my balance sheet funded, just to get through today, maybe tomorrow, hopefully to next week, maybe next month.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, thank you very much for your time. That was, like always, just an incredible conversation. For my viewers, where can they go to find out more about you?
Everything I do is usually posted on alhambrapartners.com. which is a website for my company, Alhambra Investments. And I'm working on something called Eurodollar University, which is a collaborative effort with people in Alhambra and outside of Alhambra to try to give people, you know, more insight and more resources to understand these kinds of things and to do it in sort of a better intuitive way that you can understand what's going on with the Fed. You understand what QE is and what it really is and how it can impact everything. So that's called Eurodollar University. We're working on that diligently to get that up and running.
And you guys started your own YouTube channel. So everyone should go there and subscribe. The name of the YouTube channel is Alhambra Investments, correct?
Yeah. And we called our podcast Making Sense, which, I mean, there's a lot of Making Sense podcasts out there. But we thought, you know, Making Sense, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sense of all of these things. So yeah, we have a YouTube channel and a podcast, and we hope to add, you know, some more things to it to really try to explain in individual modules these concepts, you know, repo markets, collateral lending, you know, TED spread, those, all those kinds of things, to really get into detail and let people in on the shadow money system.
Okay, fantastic. So everyone go to Jeff's YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe. Go to his website. He's got a blog there that he posts almost every single day, sometimes a couple times a day. And if you're not checking out his blog post, trust me, you are missing out. So Jeff, again, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And I cannot wait to do this again.
All right, George. Pleasure to see you, man. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.